Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
Welcome back to Radio Boston's Week in Review. I'm Tiziana Deering, and boy, has it been a week.
We've faced frightening situations before, and we learned what it means to be Boston strong. That's the strength we need right now.
If we ignore the guidelines on social distancing, we will be putting ourselves and everyone else at a much higher risk.
There will be an enormous increase in the amount of testing that takes place on a daily basis.
With many schools closed due to the virus, the Department of Education will not enforce standardized testing requirements, very importantly.
We have issued emergency procedures to set forth a process for opening exempt emergency child care programs.
This morning, the Treasury Department also announced that we're moving tax day from April 15th to July 15th.
I think every governor in the United States has been banging on the door of the federal government with respect to the stockpile.
If somebody has a chance to sell to you or has a chance to sell to me, I'm going to lose every one of those.
All right, Charlie. Thank you very much. Well, we do like you going out, seeing what you can get, if you can get it faster. And price is always a component of that also.
So we're going to put out an executive order today. New York State on pause.
In California with Governor Newsom and this morning with Governor Cuomo. And I applaud them. They're taking very strong, bold steps, and I applaud them.
We are not planning any shelter-in-place orders.
Massachusetts reports its first COVID-19 death, and the governor has activated the National Guard. Where are we right now in this coronavirus outbreak? It's time to take stock. Still with us is WBUR's Common Health editor, Carrie Goldberg, who is joining us for a call-in again today. Carrie, thanks so much for staying with us.
You're welcome.
Also with us on the line is Marcela Garcia, editorial writer, columnist, and editorial board member at the Boston Globe. Marcela, it's good to have you.
Thank you for having me.
And joining us via Skype is Tom Nichols. He's a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, and the Harvard Extension School. Hey there, Tom. Good to have you.
Good to be back with you, Tiziana.
Pull up a chair at the table. We'd love to have your call. Join us. What's been on your mind this week as we face down this coronavirus outbreak together? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Marcela, I think I'll start with you, and I feel I have to ask, while not unexpected, it is still heartbreaking to hear about this first death here in the Commonwealth today. What's your reaction in hearing the news?
It's very sad. Like you said, the fact that it was expected doesn't make it any less sad. And really, I've been thinking about this family and this person. It's we knew it was coming, but it's just heartbreaking to think of what they will be going through. We have been seeing and hearing the stories, you know, coming from Washington, the nursing home where all these patients died, and how the families were not even able to mourn properly. They couldn't see the body. They couldn't see the person even in their last hours. And it's just heartbreaking to think that someone is going through that right now.
Tom, while someone's going through that, I've heard a number of people over this last week sort of marvel at the way that time feels as if it has been compressed. A day seems like a week's worth of events. A week seems like a month's worth of events. Over the last week, in your mind, what stands out as the biggest change or the most important thing that's happened in all of this craziness?
From a personal point of view, I would say that the thing that strikes me over the past few days is the sudden feel of insecurity just walking out of my door. Mm-hmm. That a week ago, I didn't think anything of it to go around the corner to, you know, the local mini mart to get a gallon of milk. And suddenly that's like a really tough decision. How long will I be out? What am I going to touch? Where will I be? How many people are in there? I think for a lot of reasons, the fact that we're Americans, we live in an open society, you know, this is a completely unnatural feeling. And so that really struck me. And I feel like I've lost days, you know, just kind of, I actually sat down to do one of my classes by distance and realized that I was off by a week.
Oh, my.
You know, so I definitely feel this very sharply, as I think everybody else does.
Let's take a call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Dave's on the line from Plymouth, Massachusetts. Dave, welcome. Go ahead.
Hi. Two questions. First of all, for Carrie, where do we stand at the hospitals right now? I mean, are they overwhelmed yet? Are there lots of people coming in that think they're sick and then they're sending them home? Are there lots of people being admitted, or is this all anticipatory right now? And then the second question I have is for everybody. What are we going to say is safe? I mean, I know right now we're kind of waiting it out for a few weeks. And then what do we know is going to be when it's safe to get back to our lives? And then also, who gets to decide that?
Great questions, Dave. I may have you come back and co-host with me next week because those are fabulous questions and well-pointed. Carrie, you first. What about the Dave's hospitals question?
So the short answer is that it's still mostly anticipatory. We're getting the numbers of patients from the hospitals every day at the end of the day. And so far, the numbers are relatively small. I mean, you know, a sprinkling of people in the ICU who have tested positive, dozens of patients is the order of magnitude of patients who have tested positive or are suspected of being positive and who are being treated. There are a couple of reasons to be sort of worried about what's to come, though, because we definitely are before. So it can rise fairly quickly. And what I learned today from this professor, Mark Lipsitch, is that the treatment for the lung problems that arise with COVID-19 can keep you in the ICU for a long time. For weeks. And so there, you know, the part of the concern is that the ICUs could get very crowded quickly
as those numbers grow. And mm-hmm. Marcella Garcia, let me turn to you. Tom talked about the biggest change this last week was not feeling safe when he stepped out his door. Then Dave says, so what is safe going to be? What is it going to mean to feel safe or not safe? And how are we going to get safe again?
I don't think there's a right answer to this question. And it's very frustrating. I totally share Dave's sense of uncertainty. I think we're all trying to figure it out. You know, we've been hearing this message, right, coming from public health officials, the government, act as if you already have the virus, right? And, you know, that's good because you want to protect yourself, but also you want to protect others. And I think that's helping people stay in place. But at the same time, I think policies also have to follow that directive, right? If we all act as, or hopefully we all act, as if we have the virus, what does that mean for public policy, right? At some point, do we have to go into lockdown, and what does that mean? And so all these questions, I think, are very, very sensible and obviously natural for people to have, which is why I feel that the government, our state government, has a very, very big responsibility keeping us informed at all times. I think the state might be able to do a little bit better on that, and I'm sure we were going to talk about that more, but you got to feel that void somehow.
And I do want to get to another call, but before I do, Tom Nichols, what about the flow of information coming at the local level, the state level, the federal level? You know, how would you grade the job we're doing in getting quality, transparent information out?
Well, two things. First, let me just go back to the question of safety for a moment, I think the important thing, and I just had this talk last night with my teenage daughter who asked me the same question. She said, Dad, when will things ever be normal again? And I said, look, people can always get sick from things. The key right now is for all of us not to get sick at the same time. And that's the really, I think, the thing people have to, as Marcella pointed out, you know, act as if you have it, because the issue here is, aside from this being a nasty piece of work as a virus, you know, we have advanced hospitals and ICUs, but we can't all be sick at the same time. And that's what I kept trying to
say earlier too. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I told my daughter, I said, look, that life is not without risk. You can always get the flu. You can get food poisoning, get all kinds of things, but you don't want to all get them at the same time. As for the flow of information, I think one of the real positives insofar as we can find, you know, something to say about this crisis that's optimistic is state governments, at least most of the state governments, there are some notable exceptions, but state governments and governors have really stepped up and have been, I think, much better with their people, which is what you would expect in a federal system. You know, I think one of the things we can take away from this is federalism is working well, even if the response in Washington, I've been very critical of the response in D.C. I think it's been chaotic. I think it's been contradictory. But I live in Rhode Island, and, you know, Governor Raimondo has been, you know, every day getting the word out. We get emails from Representative Cicilline in his district. You know, Governor Baker has been stepping up. Governor Pritzker in Illinois, Governor Cuomo, I think, did a really good job. And as you know, these are not, you know, it's not natural for somebody like coming from my background to talk about what a great governor Andrew Cuomo is, but he's doing a really good job.
I admit to a
and
bit
so
of surprise.
So I think that's a good thing.
Yeah. All right. There is a call I want to get to here. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Patricia on the line from Somerset, Massachusetts. Patricia, welcome to the table. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Yes, I'm sitting in a parking lot at Home Depot right now in Somerset, Massachusetts, watching contractors come out empty-handed, looking for masks for their work. But that's not why I called. I have a son who has a severe mental illness, an adult disabled child. My husband and I are retired. I'm a retired RN. He's a retired police officer. I'm in my late 60s. He's in his early 70s, and we have underlying health conditions, okay? My son is living, he's married. He's in his late 30s. He's in the gig economy, or he was until a week ago. He's a solo acoustic act and a singer. And he's the guy you see in the corner of a restaurant who's singing that you can pay attention to or not. Anyway, he is getting very stressed. He's losing sleep because of money. He was discarded from the Social Security Disability Program about 4 years ago, and I will use the word discarded, after about 10 years of being disabled. He is suddenly cured, but of course he's not. Anyway, the problem is, that's a whole other story with the Social Security and Disability Services, but the gentleman who was just speaking about the governor of Rhode Island, I'm also very impressed with her, but I'm really calling it because I live in Rhode Island, actually.
So, Patricia, I want to pick it up from here. It's such a challenging situation that you're in, and I feel it for you. And I want to turn to our panelists and ask, Patricia's one example of people who are facing, a set of challenges, and it seems like every aspect of the safety net, they're falling through it. So what do we do? Marcella, maybe I'll go to you first, and then Carrie, I'll go to you after that. Marcella.
Well, one of the things that the governor here in Massachusetts, and I'm not sure if Governor Raimondo has done this in Rhode Island, but he expanded access to telemedicine services, including behavioral health services. And I think this is an area, granted there are economic troubles and financial issues, but just speaking on the public health angle, all these patients are going to lose access. They cannot go to the clinic. They cannot go to therapy. They expanded, Governor Baker expanded access to telemedicine, meaning that you can call or use a video conference link to see your doctor. And again, the expansion of the services means that a mass health is covering it. The state-run service, I don't know what it's called in Rhode Island, but also President Trump did, some policy moves to that end as well. So I know that it may not sound a lot to Patricia or her son, but at least that's something that is happening right now. Again, I don't know if in Rhode Island this is available, but this is an area that could really make a difference right now when patients are being closed off from clinics and community centers. And again, it's important that behavioral health services are covered too. And here in Massachusetts, the expansion includes that. I spoke to a clinic in East Boston this morning that, they're doing nearly 300 calls a day. And so it's, again, it's not the same, but these are the type of policy moves that we should be thinking about and expanding. And like Tom said, it's really a matter of the governors, right? This would be an area that maybe the Rhode Island governor could expand into if she hasn't already done this.
Carrie Goldberg, let me give you a chance to react to that and to the caller.
Yeah, I absolutely second what Marcella says, that I just recently did a story about telemedicine and how it was a bit slow to take off, but this crisis is making it just boom. And in fact, these virtual visits used for psychotherapy have been one of the most successful pieces of telemedicine. And so that should be available, some kind of video therapy. And also, judging by what the state officials were saying an hour ago, it should be easier than usual to get state health insurance, the Rhode Island version of Medicaid, if that's something that could be helpful. But I don't have an answer to, I mean, so many people have their income just falling through the floor. I think that answer is probably going to come federally.
And Tom Nichols, do you think the federal government, is that the set of priorities the federal government's thinking about right now? I mean, we're talking about we've delayed tax season, the possibility of up to $1,200 in cash for individuals in the country, although the more you make, the more you get, the less you make, the less that payout might be. Are the priorities in the right place for the reality of day-to-day life for people in the federal response as it's being planned?
I'm not sure where the federal, I should say, I don't represent the federal government, and I'm not sure where the federal government's priorities are right now. I mean, we had a press conference this morning that I think probably did more harm than good on that score.
Why do you say that, Tom?
Because I think it leaves us unable to make heads or tails out of what the government's doing. I mean, I would be perfectly happy to just have Dr. Fauci come out for a half an hour every day and just tell us where we are instead of these angry back and forth kind of, you know, political spectacles that the president's been putting on every morning, because I don't really understand where the federal response is. And the only people that seem to make sense to me are Fauci and Birx when they talk, but they don't really get to talk very much. I think where the federal government, you know, after I just extolled the virtues of federalism, I have to agree that I think that this is a case where, you know, under our constitutional system of government, we're promoting the general welfare. You know, this is a national emergency, and I think we should pull out all the stops. Now, whether that means, I mean, I don't need a check, and I think just randomly sending money all over the country is probably not a great idea. But I think that people who are being destroyed by this, like your caller and her family, they need to be made whole, because this is what government is for. Moments like this, where there is a national emergency, where, you know, the size of the crisis is bigger than any one state can handle. And I think this is one of those cases that I think transcends partisan politics or political ideology, where to me, this is like war. You know, this is a where all of our hardships are, you know, bundled together, and we all have to sacrifice. And so I hope that the federal government's priority is to make people whole and to make sure that nobody is destroyed and their lives are not destroyed. With that said, there are going to be people that are going to be out of work. There are going to be companies that are going to go broke. You know, we just have to try to knit back the part of the social safety net as best we can that deals with those problems.
All right. I'm going to take a quick break here, Tom. Thanks for that. Everybody sit tight. We're going to take a quick break because the clock needs us to. We'll be back in a minute. Our panelists are still with us. That includes WBUR's Common Health editor, Carrie Goldberg, Marcela Garcia, who's an editorial writer, columnist, and editorial board member at the Boston Globe, and Tom Nichols, who's a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, and at the Harvard Extension School. Calls have been coming in, and I want to go to one right away, and I'm not going to bring the caller on air because they wanted to remain anonymous, but the caller said, "I work for a delivery company. We deliver in over 100 towns. I'm on the low end, and no one is talking about how safe this is for us and others." It makes me think about all of the people who are at risk and invisible in this moment. And I want to invite our panelists to talk about that a little bit. Marcela, maybe you can go first.
Yeah, that is an excellent point. And it's a question that a lot of us have been asking and really wondering about. Someone has to disinfect buildings. You know, the janitor in our building, she is a Salvadoran woman that I become friends with, and she was telling me that, you know, one day they were called to disinfect, you know, 10 floors of our building. We're obviously not there. We're all working from home. All the Globe staff is working from home. So on top of that, she also lost work, right? So it's this invisible population that obviously did not become invisible overnight. They have been invisible for a while. And in times of crisis and emergencies, obviously their vulnerabilities and their struggles amplify. And I don't mean in the sense that we see them more, but they just have more struggles. So I think it's important to keep them in mind. Also the workers at CVS and the pharmacies and the supermarkets, right? These are the places that are keeping us alive. What are we doing for them? There was a call for our government, for our state government, to also treat them as essential workers, as other states have done. But not just them, right? Also all these invisible force of workers who are delivering our groceries here, so we don't have to go out, or the food that we order,
Marcella,
from restaurants.
We actually have a caller who I think picks up on that, so I'd like to turn to that caller now. And just a reminder that the phone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Larry is on the line from Clinton. Larry, go ahead.
Hi. So nobody's really defining essential worker, and it's getting to the point where your employer, I work as an electrician, and, you know, nobody's telling us not to go to work because, you know, to everyone, you're an essential employee to their business. So I took the responsibility of just taking the day off. I actually took yesterday off, too. But I can't collect because I'm being responsible.
You mean you can't collect unemployment?
Correct, yeah, because I'm voluntarily not going to work because I feel like that's the right thing to do. But, you know, nobody's really telling me not to go to work.
Larry,
I know there's a lot of other people in my shoes.
Who are in the same shoes. Larry, I really appreciate that call. And Carrie Goldberg, I'm going to turn to you. There's Larry's case. I'm also thinking about the fact that I asked Steve Poftak, the general manager of the MBTA, yesterday if MBTA workers qualified as emergency personnel and could take advantage of the child care options that are being provided. And he said that they did not qualify as essential either. What are we hearing? Are there official definitions out there about who is essential personnel?
I have not heard them. I'm actually struggling with this from the public health point of view, though, because the implication seems to be that if you go out anywhere in society, you are putting yourself at risk. And I don't feel like that's the message that we've been getting from the public health officials. What they've been saying is this is a virus that is overwhelmingly transmitted by droplets. And so what you most want to do is stay 6 feet away from other people, at least. You really don't want them to, you know, cough or sneeze on you or talk to you too close. And I've also, you know, what we've been learning in the last few days is that it seems like one of the reasons this disease is so contagious is because a lot of the transmission happens when people are not showing symptoms yet or just at the very beginning of symptoms. So I my takeaway from this is what I'm really scared of is other people, not so much touching things, although there has also been research that found that the virus could linger on surfaces like metal for a couple of days. But that the hand washing takes care of that. All of the messages we're getting about wash your hands, don't touch your face, keep your distance. And so I understand it's a difficult issue about who's essential because you don't want to go out because we've all been told not to go out. But it is a separate issue from are you actually putting yourself at risk if you go someplace and do something.
Let's stay with that for a minute, because Tom Nichols, you're a professor of national security affairs. Do we know who's supposed to say in moments of crisis who's essential and who's not? Is there like some standard national definition, or is this another situation where it's locally determined and could be different everywhere?
Well, the government and the Defense Department, and again, better be sure to say I don't represent the Defense Department, they have at each command, they will tell you who are their essential personnel so that when an order goes out that says, listen, we are in a, you know, like during hurricanes or snowstorms, this happens, essential personnel only. And there are lists in those institutions. I mean, at my institution, we know who the essential personnel are, and they're allowed to come into the building and others aren't. Elsewhere, no, there isn't some national registry of essential workers. We are a very, you know, the thing that helps us is also the thing that can be difficult for us at a time like this. If you're a country like Singapore, you know, a city state with a very professional civil service and a public that is used to kind of doing what the government tells them to do, you can control a lot of this. In a huge decentralized country like ours, you know, who's essential? Well, you know, somebody in Idaho who works in the state government might see that differently than somebody who's a regulator in Mississippi. And that's the way it ought to be most of the time. And I think what we're really being called upon here to do is not to make lists of who's essential, but to use our common sense and to be steadfast about acting. You know, everyone's already said it again, acting as if you already have the virus. If you knew that you were carrying this, what would you do? Now, that doesn't help. Your caller makes a great point. You know, it doesn't help the people that have to go to work. And I'll just come back to saying that's what government is for, to help the people that are going to get thrown out of work, to smooth that transition. But no, there is no national registry of essential people. I mean, we just have to play that by ear.
Let's invite another caller to the table here. We've got Matt on the line from Framingham. Matt, go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon, everybody. I'm calling. I've got something not quite as serious as Patricia's from a few minutes ago, but as it happens, I'm a divorced dad. I've got two kids that I share custody with my ex-wife. We get on fine, but they live they spend most of their time with mom, and they're about an hour west of me. And so we're coming up upon my dad's weekend, right? And I'm really concerned about the back and forth between two separate households of my children. And I'm, you know, as it happens in my case, my daughter is immunocompromised due to a prior medical procedure from a year or two ago. And I'm just kind of curious what your thoughts are about divorced parents who might share custody and the back and forth that occasionally, often happens.
It's a great question, Matt. And here's what I'd like to do. Carrie, I'd like to get a quick healthcare perspective from you on that. And then, Marcella, I'm going to pivot it to a little bit larger question for you. Carrie, go ahead.
Well, my sense from public health officials is that the idea of sort of quarantining yourself is to limit the number of people you come into contact with so that they can't infect you and you can't infect them. But it sounds to me like what you have is a family that happens to be split between two households. If you were living in the same household, you would still have the same number of people. So I guess it's mainly a question of the surfaces, the additional surfaces that are exposed, that the people are exposed to. And then I would say, so then just clean them even more. That's the best I can do on that one.
I actually find that to be an encouraging answer, Carrie. And Marcella, where I wanted to turn to you on this is, in the background, as we've had calls and we've been thinking about this and talking to various healthcare professionals, the social emotional needs of families in this time of great isolation, when we are a social species, is a concern, but nobody really knows what to say about it or do about it when we all have to stay home. What is the balance between people's needs for contact across families, across households, with this need to maintain our public health responsibilities to each other? How do we even think about that?
Well, I think there are options, right? We have new technologies available. I mean, I don't know about you, but I've been finding a lot of comfort in just calling people on the phone. And I have FaceTimes with my friends. I have a very good close friend of mine who we sort of made a pact of doing daily FaceTime chats, right? And it's a matter of adapting, I think, to the new normal. To use a phrase that has become a cliche, but it's true. We are in a new normal, and thankfully we have technologies to adapt. And so the balance the line has definitely been moved, but I think we can achieve a balance, right? There's been a lot of memes talking about how this was introverts' time to shine, you know? Like, but everyone, no one is an island, right? We all need human contact, but you know, go outside. It's also, I've been hearing about, what a terrible time to be dealing with a pandemic, just as we are going to get into the best season in Boston, right? Spring. But that doesn't mean that we have to stay inside. You know, I've been taking a lot of walks with my dog and my husband. And so I think it's just this whole time I've been trying to take this time to rethink and to use it as an opportunity, right? I've been also working out more. Who knew, right?
Well, that's good.
I have a machine here that has sat there for, just basically on use. But now I've been making a point. I have another friend who is urging me to do it every day. And I think that's wonderful. I think we're all we all have to find, time, the new balance, right? And use the technology.
So let me jump in here. And I'm going to let our callers go. Callers, I'm sorry we weren't able to get more of you. Many of you have healthcare-oriented questions. We will do another call in with medical professionals next Monday. So you can call again in Radio Boston on Monday and get some of those answers. We usually do hubbubs at the end. We wanted to leave a little time today to have everybody offer something that brought joy or inspiration this week after such a heavy week. And so I wanted to leave a little time for that. Tom, what's yours?
Well, it just happened. Actually, my hubbub about Boston is about my part-time job at the Harvard Extension School. But I just want to give a shout out to your caller and say, I totally feel his pain. I am a divorced father who shares custody, and I totally know how he feels. And it's a tough one. At the Harvard Extension School, we went to distance. And one of the things that made me kind of happy was to realize that because we were kind of a leader in doing distance and online programs, that the transition for a lot of us was really not that difficult. I mean, it was tough to have to leave the campus and not see the students. But I think a shout out to a lot of the extension and non-traditional programs out there who were ready for this almost by accident, because they had been pioneering these methods of getting education to people who can't make it to a campus. And so I'm feeling pretty good about the fact that, you know, for about 10 years now, I've been part of an institution that really has been pretty good at this.
That's great. Carrie, briefly, do you have one?
Well, actually, I have a bit of news that I forgot to mention at the top, which is that Boston Children's Hospital reported its first patient to test positive with COVID-19. And it just made me think of, it's not joy or inspiration, it's gratitude. Like, the one good thing that I can say about this virus is that it doesn't tend to kill children. So at least there's that. And even though I hate it because it kills elders who I treasure and you know, middle-aged people, but at least it doesn't kill kids like the flu. That's the best thing I can say.
We'll take gratitude from everywhere. Marcella, briefly, how about you?
I'm also going to be very self-promotional and give a shout out to our letters to the editor at The Globe, Matt Bernstein. He started a new feature this week called Postcards from the Pandemic, and he's giving sort of an overview of how Globe readers are coping, and it's very, very inspirational. There's the guy who, you know, realized that now he has all this time to write thank you notes, and he's writing one thank you note a day because he does indeed have so much to be thankful for. And there's so many good inspirational things here. Someone who's also saying, I'm leaving my shelter in place beard, I'm not shaving. Someone who's saying, that this is a moment to rise up and meet yourself and to be together apart.
All right.
So,
all right. Marcella Garcia, that's great. Marcella Garcia of the Boston Globe, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Tom Nichols, professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College and the Harvard Extension School, thanks.
Thank you.
Common Health editor Carrie Goldberg, we sure appreciate it.
My pleasure.